Let me quote from his new book some of the new problems that he feels challenge the liberal mentality. And this is quoting from his new book. It's a mentality geared to protecting workers in the workplace and promoting unionism, now being asked to worry about productivity. A mentality geared to stopping the war in Vietnam is now being called upon to ponder a Soviet arms buildup and Soviet aggression in Afghanistan. A mentality geared to keeping consumer prices down is now being called upon to worry not about the price of gasoline, but its supply. A mentality geared to opposing nuclear power is now being urged to concern itself with the source of electricity in an era of reduced oil production. That's quoting from his new book. The school of thought has been referred to as the new liberalism, but Senator Tsonga says he prefers to call it compassionate realism. He describes the changes he thinks needs to be made in liberal thought and policy in his new book, which is called The Road From Here, Liberalism and Realities in the 80s. It's just been published by Knopf. Paul Tsongas was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1974 and to the Senate in 1978. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
What's wrong with liberalism?
Well, I suppose that you could ask the same question about conservative ideology, that really any philosophy that loses the capacity to evolve, that is unable to, in essence, reassess as you go on, will eventually become irrelevant. And although the values, if you will, of liberalism remain intact, because that's what in this country has been founded upon the 200 years since, in fact, that the approach has been found wanting by the American public. And I think liberals, if they're honest with themselves, will agree that there is a need for evolution and reassessment.
Now, you call what the policy and philosophy that you're working on to be compassionate realism. And that word, that expression to me implies that you think that liberalism isn't realistic.
It isn't. Well, let me put it this way. The values of economic justice, to use one, are realistic, because if you don't have economic justice, you have chaos, and that will, in essence, devour the system over time. But what we've done, in essence, is assumed an approach where you simply, if there's a problem, you throw money at it. And there was never a sense of how social programs, for instance, relate to how the economy is doing, that there's not an endless supply of money to be used in whatever way we want. You had the same problem, indeed, with the reaction to the Soviets, that there has been, in fact, a Soviet buildup. Now, you don't react to it in a kind of Reagan-esque arms race, but in fact, it's there, and if you don't address it, the country eventually will turn away from you and let someone like President Reagan address it. So I think the implications of not being realistic are you will eventually be defeated, and be defeated by those who would take a much more conservative approach to issues.
So you think the framework developed during the period of Vietnam, for instance, of peace and what were called dovish attitudes, mm-hmm. isn't functional now?
It's not that it's not. I think the anti-Vietnam era, and I was part of the demonstrations against the war in Vietnam, was appropriate to its time. And there was an imbalance. There was, in essence, a non-reality that we had to address. But in fact, the Soviets are in Afghanistan. That is a clear invasion. They have engaged in this 4% a year buildup, and you have to address that. Again, you don't err on the side of extreme, as we are doing in national policy today. But I think you have to deal with the world that's out there, not the one you wish would be out there. But the basic thesis of the book is, in essence, here are problems, and here's how you deal with them, as non-ideologically, hopefully, as possible.
Let me just mention that we'll be opening up the phones in a little while if you have any questions or comments that you'd like to address to my guest, Senator Paul Tsongas. Well, you've told us a little bit about why you've become disenchanted with liberalism, but what are some of the what's some of the framework of what you call compassionate realism? What are some of the things you're working towards?
Well, first of all, the term compassionate realism is the best we could do. When you try to come up with a title for a book or a slogan, it becomes very difficult. In essence, what I'm saying is that the noun is realism. You start off with the question, what works? And once you've decided upon that, then you have latitude, whether you want to be a conservative within that framework or a liberal. And I'm arguing for liberalism because that's where the compassion comes from. And indeed, a society without compassion eventually is very hard to sustain. Liberals have traditionally gone at it the other way around. In other words, you start off, where's the compassion? And if the realism fit in, that's fine. If it doesn't, well, that's fine as well. If you take issues, for example, the energy issue, one of the realities out there is that you have to price energy at its replacement cost. that oil is a finite diminishing resource, and that's the base of the energy issue. To the extent you don't accept decontrol, you operate outside of reality, because otherwise conservation and renewable resources don't kick in, don't become important. And so decontrol is something you have to live with. And I, as a liberal, representing a consumer state, that's very difficult, but that's where you have to be. Now, within that, you can either have a windfall profits tax to maximize, in essence, the shock absorber effect of a weatherization program for homes of the poor, a conservation bank to help middle-income people conserve, and so forth. A conservative would say to you, we don't need a windfall profits tax, let the free market prevail. So within the reality, you have a certain latitude to either be compassionate or not.
What message do you think the election last year of Ronald Reagan to the office of presidency should have for liberals?
Well, this is obviously arguable, but my own view is that the election in 1980 was a mandate. It's not just a question of President Reagan having defeated President Carter. I mean, that was all there was. You could sort of write it off to anti-Carterism. But I lost a lot of my friends in the Senate. I mean, people who were very substantive and worked hard and so forth. So there really was a mandate, and I think the mandate was against what they perceived to be a democratic inability to run the country, whether that's an economic policy or foreign policy, but a sense of drift. Now, it was not, in my mind, a mandate for extremes of the right having rejected extremes of the left. Once you start dealing with things like the Kemp-Roth part of the tax cut and the arms race, you have gone outside the new reality. And they will have exactly the same problems that we had on the left. I think there was a clear sense that the country wanted change, not unlike, by the way, what France did in Greece recently, going to the left. We happened to go to the right, so there was a clear sense that, hey, this is not working, let's try something else. But the president, I think, would be in error if he assumed that he could engage in this arms race or have these massively deficits and still retain support.
But did that victory for Reagan and other Republicans send a message to you that it was time for you to start changing your point of view?
Well, I had spoken out on this issue before the election and had received a lot of criticism, kind of a heresy, if you will. After the election, there was a great deal more open-mindedness, nothing like getting clobbered to really, in essence, expand your capacity to absorb information. And when you lose to that extent, you simply begin to think. The Democratic senators, for example, get together now. We never did that before. And so I think liberals, having been so demolished, are far more willing to talk about things, whereas before November, what I was saying was met with some hostility.
Let's look at some of the specific things that you've been thinking about and trying to work through. Policy suggestions are, in Philadelphia, people have been very concerned with unions. We've been through a number of strikes, and I think the city's probably pretty divided on on its stand. We're in the middle of a very long, maybe it's not the middle, a very long teacher's strike that is in progress now. The whole country has been examining the PATCO strike. You're suggesting something called the new unionism. What is the new unionism?
Well, one of the building blocks of the old FDR coalition were the unions. And the Democratic Party has been very responsive to unions over time. In fact, my voting record on union issues is extraordinarily positive. But the fact is that unionism has diminished in this country, that the public perception of unions has changed, in essence, from one of protector to one of abuser, that unions have become too big, too powerful, too insensitive. And that resulting decline of public perception gives the president the opportunity to go after PATCO and be well-received, having gone after PATCO. I suspect sentiment in this community probably runs strong as well on both sides. What I'm saying, in essence, is that unions want to survive over the long term. They have to present a very different public face, that they should be talking about issues like productivity, quality control, production, the lack of absenteeism, that kind of thing, that, in essence, the enemy is not management. The enemy is their Japanese counterparts of industry as a whole, and that if you present a public face that talks about a much more progressive view of the job and so forth, public opinion will swing around. Absent that new public face, I think unionism in this country is in real trouble.
The unions are faced now in many instances with contracts that have to be negotiated with multinationals who have bases in many mm-hmm. different countries. How do you think that that's affected the ability of unions to negotiate contracts and the kinds of problems they see themselves as being up against? And how does that fit into your philosophy?
Well, what I would call for is a situation where unions and management work cooperatively, very much like they do in Japan. If you have, for example, the UAW in this country, the United Automobile Workers, demands out of Chrysler or Ford, to use the two that are in the most trouble, and that prevents them over time from competing with the Japanese, both have lost. And so absence the cooperation between the parties, the only victor in the negotiations of the Japanese or the Germans or the Swiss or whatever, that's a very different approach because traditionally it's been unions, management, head-to-head, toe-to-toe, who is going to get most of the pie. Well, if there's no pie, they're both in trouble. And that requires a quantum, if you will, shift in attitude, both on the part of unions and indeed on the part of management as well.
But I think that a lot of people in unions perceive that the interests of labor and management are not one and the same, in part because of the multinational, since many corporations are packing up and leaving either the state or leaving the country. So, you know, the corporations don't necessarily rely on the workers of the area they're in now.
Well, that's true, but to the extent a union, for example, in one country, not to be in tougher on issues like productivity, it in essence becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you're a multinational, you're going to go to Mexico or you're going to go to Europe or Japan or whatever, and there are jobs at stake, especially now with the Japanese, for example, getting into high technology, which is what the Northeast is really going to rely upon over time for our industrial base. One should be very concerned. Sure, there are problems, and there have been abuses traditionally. There will be more in the future. Multinationals do have divided loyalties. But unions, like everybody else, are in this struggle for survival, and they will have to evolve in order to survive, very much like liberals. The old ways simply don't work. And the fight is among traditionalists who say what we did was right and nothing wrong with what we did, and we're going to continue with it, and those of us who have been termed the revisionists, who argue it's time to win something.
Well, the Delaware Valley, and I know the area that you're from in Massachusetts, have both been through a period of suffering high unemployment, in part because of the leaving of factories and manufacturing positions. What are the ways in this new unionism that you're describing of preventing runaway shops and of keeping the jobs in the state or the city that you're from?
Well, in the case of my own state, which I am obviously more familiar with, in fact, the industries that are in decline, or at least have stabilized, are the traditional industries that happen to be unionized. Those industries that are in the increase, where the jobs are coming from, are almost without exception non-union, high technology, computer companies, that kind of thing. Now, and why is it happening that way? And that is that people who have a job and security and good wages look at unions and say, we don't want to be part of that because we're afraid that if we do, that we'll be worse off than we are now. If unions presented a face where they not only protect people, which I think is still very important, but that protection does not create feather bedding or a kind of a very sort of calcium-plated view of the world, then they're far more likely to do well. The average worker in my state who's not unionized is very unlikely to want to go in that direction for fear of setting in motion a chain of events that leads to the kind of attitudes that leads to the decline of the industry. They have to turn that around. It's going to be tough.
During the debate over the Chrysler bailout, you voted for it and also suggested that the workers at Chrysler, instead of taking the wage increase that they had expected, take instead stocks in the company.
That's
so
right.
That if the company did well, they'd share in those profits, and they'd have a vested interest in ensuring that the company did well. You must have gotten a lot of flack for that.
Well, I was a very traditional liberal with a very good labor voting record, a very good liberal voting record. And when the Chrysler case came up, I was on the banking committee that had jurisdiction over it. And I looked at those numbers, and it seemed to me that the $1.1 billion we were giving to the unions guarantee the demise of Chrysler. So what are you doing? And by coming out, in essence, for the wage freeze, that was perceived as be anti-union, whereas in fact we were doing that to save the company. And if you don't save the company, what good have you done the workers? It just became one of those situations where I said to myself, either they're right or I'm right, but we both cannot be right. And that began the process which led to the reassessment, which led to the book. So I'm somewhat indebted to Chrysler for that.
At what point do you think that the government should bail out a private company? Because as you point out in your book, Chrysler probably should have been rethinking their car designs long ago, and it was really their own fault because of their own policies that they were suffering so much in the auto market. And it seems that one of the basic tenets of a capitalistic society is that you're rewarded for your ingenuity, and you're kind of punished if you can't cut it. And here's the government stepping in and saying, well, you blew it. You didn't make the right decisions. Mm. And you've kind of ruined your own company, but here we'll help out.
The rationale for helping Chrysler was not what they had done in the past, because that was stupid. I mean, any damn fool could have seen what was coming. But the fact is they had on the drawing boards the best line of small cars of the big three, the Omni, Horizon line, the K cars. And that was the rationale, that in essence you give them a bridge loan to get them to the point where they have viability. Now they're in trouble now, not because of their product line, because of high interest rates that they have absolutely no blame for. My view is that you look at which countries are doing well, Japanese, the Germans, and ask yourself, how are they doing? And if you look at the Japanese model, which I think is by far the best, you have a tradition of governmental activism, a government willing, in essence, to be Darwinian, to say, this is where the future is, photovoltaics, for example. This is where the past was, shipbuilding, and to begin to make credit decisions accordingly. We're going to come to that. If we don't, if we pursue a kind of purist laissez-faire system, which is what we're doing today, that's fine. It'll keep all the ideologues happy, but don't expect to compete with the Japanese over time.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Senator Paul Tsongas, and he's written a new book, which is a reevaluation of liberalism, and it's called The Road From Here. Now, what about government funding of social programs? Have you reevaluated that as well?
Government funding of social programs is a function of how the economy is going, that there is no such thing as an absolute amount of money for programs. If the economy is dissipating, by definition, and you have a contracting economy, you're less generous because you have less money to work from. That's a very tough reality to have to confront. Assuming that happens, which is what's happening today, you have to be willing to make distinctions between programs. The fact is that not all social programs are equally worthwhile. And it's up to liberals like myself to be willing to say, this one, in fact, is better than that one. And how I would do it would be to maximize the amount of money I would put into what we would refer to as developmental programs, Head Start, college loan program, child nutrition, the so-called UDAG program for cities, in essence, where money is put in and that money is an investment in the future. And I would take the money, if I had to choose, out of a program like the public service component of CETA or something like the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program or Extended Unemployment Compensation, where the money is paid in and it's gone. There's no hope of any subsequent return. That kind of need to distinguish is not in our tradition. You know, here's a hurt, we meet it with this kind of money, and never being willing to say, is there an end to the program? Are we willing to reassess it? Are we willing to curb the abuses that take place? Not having been willing to do that just opened the way for the conservatives to come in and just blow us away.
So you think that some programs needed to be cut back, but not across the board?
Well, what happened was that if you spoke out against a program, you were perceived to be speaking out against the value. And, that sort of intermingling of the two is ideological. And we paid the price.
What do you do with a program like the food stamp program, which probably does not function perfectly?
Mm-hmm.
There's probably a lot of people getting it who don't deserve it, and people on salary who maybe don't do the job they're supposed to be doing, which you could say happens in just about every large organization.
Sure.
So what do you do with a program
like that?
Sure, yeah. What do you do with a program like that that's not perfect, but that is serving a function?
I think if you recognize the fact that it's not perfect and are willing to be tough in administration, that if you give the public a perception, yes, there are going to be abuses, but we're going to be very tough in making sure we minimize them. The public can live with that, the sense of, yes, there are needy that have to be taken care of, and we understand that, and we provide the compassion. But if you're going to have a program that says, look, there is a need, and we're going to have this program, and we're just not going to administer it toughly because we don't want anybody somehow to fall between the cracks, the average person seeing the abuse in the supermarket line, is you are building a constituency that later on will come back to haunt you, which is exactly what happened in 1980.
Uh-huh. So what would you have done with food stamps and with the welfare program, aid to families with dependent children? What kind of changes would you have wanted to see made in those programs?
One, you tighten up eligibility. You recognize if you have an economy that's expanding, you can loosen eligibility. Because if everyone's doing well, you have more capacity to be generous. Whereas if the economy is beginning to contract, you have to contract as well. So you would cut down on eligibility. You know, who are the truly needy? Make that your first priority and do it in a priority sense so that as your funds decrease, you cut off those who are the least needy, but always maintain a certain amount of money for those who really do survive on those kinds of programs. That's a very, that's not an illiberal approach.
But then it gets down to your definition of what truly needy is, and that's something that everybody's been arguing about.
Well, I don't think it's that difficult. I mean, there are certain people who need to survive on those programs, people who are elderly, who are disabled, who have kids at home, that kind of thing. I don't think anyone would seriously argue
that
they're not
needy. Think where a lot of the argument has been is over people who are perfectly eligible to work, but on the other hand can't find a job. Are they the truly needy or not? If you take them away from an aid program and say, there's jobs and you're mm-hmm. able-bodied, go ahead and support your family, get a job, and they can't, then...
Well, let's use it for instance. One of the issues that came up before the Senate, I believe it was last year, said that your unemployment compensation, don't hold me to these numbers, but it's approximate, would go from 26 weeks to 52 weeks. And there was an amendment which said if you were offered a job after 26 weeks, you didn't take it, you would not be eligible for the extension. I voted for that. And somehow the idea, for example, that a college professor would say that a certain kind of work was inappropriate, when you have people who are doing exactly that kind of work paying into the government, which then provides the unemployment compensation, I think is absurd. And this is like me saying, I'm a senator, and if I should be rejected by the people, I don't want to be whatever. People would think that's ridiculous. Well, I feel the same way.
Okay, my guest is Senator Paul Tsongas of Massachusetts, and we're talking about the approach that he's taken in reevaluating liberalism. He's written a new book called The Road From Here. Let's talk a little bit about how you perceive the American relationship with the Soviet Union now. We were alluding to this a little earlier, and you were saying that the kind of Vietnam approach to world peace isn't really applicable to American-Soviet relations. Now, what do you see as being the nature of the threat of the Soviet Union to America?
I think the Soviets are an expansionist power. I mean, they have been traditionally. Marxist-Leninist theology or ideology is, by definition, a crusading approach. And I think they see themselves playing that kind of a role internationally. The problem we have is that you can recognize that, see their buildup, see what they're doing in Afghanistan, and recognize the threat for what it is, serious and has to be considered. That is quite unlike saying, as we are doing these days, that the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming, and see them as some kind of super race that have no sense of stability and so forth. The question, for example, in the arms race is whether you, in essence, understand the need to have parity with the Soviets, which means increased defense spending, as opposed to the traditional liberal view, which says that as long as you have a number of nuclear weapons, that's enough, or, in essence, the Reagan-esque view that argues for an arms race. The middle line where you have parity or so-called rough equivalents and negotiate your SALT II, SALT III, SALT IV nuclear arms treaties, I think is how you have to do it.
So you think we should be engaging in nuclear weapon negotiations now?
If we don't engage in nuclear weapons negotiations, I mean, the Russians passed SALT II. We're the ones who rejected it. We will engage in an arms race that has all kinds of implications, not only in terms of peace and war. You now see the European reaction where neutralism is beginning to take off in Europe. because they're worried about us, but also in terms of what it does to our economy. To the extent you drain all your talent, both in terms of human resources and in terms of capital, and devote it to an arms race, you don't have it available for Chrysler and everybody else to compete in every other international market.
Hundreds of thousands of Europeans marched in the streets over the weekend protesting U.S. nuclear weapons in Europe. They're afraid that Europe will be the theater for a limited nuclear war, or for what might be a limited war, what might not be a limited war. Do you think that we are risking losing our European allies?
Well, put yourself in a position of a European, and the American president, who's not known to be particularly progressive in international affairs, who is a traditional sort of east-west view person, says that neutron bombs will be likely used in Europe, not in the United States. Well, if you're a European, you've got to look at that in utter amazement. Here you have two superpowers flexing their muscles, talking about war, where, in your backyard. I would be concerned if I were in their shoes. And this sort of creepy neutralism in Europe could severely weaken NATO. And you'd have the irony that the hardline rhetoric in the United States plays exactly into the Soviet hands, which is what we do in the Third World, that our rhetoric is the perfect entree for the Soviet argument. And so those who argue the strongest against Soviet expansionism are, in fact, those people who almost guarantee the success of the Soviet approach.
You write in your book that how almost ironic it is. You were talking to Pete Domenici of New Mexico, mm-hmm. congressman from New Mexico, and he said every time he looks at his kids, he sees the possibility of them living under a Soviet regime, and he gets scared and realizes that we have to really flex our muscles. And you look at your kids, you say, and see the threat of nuclear holocaust and realize that there must be some kind of negotiation to prevent that from happening. I'm sure that kind of different outlook on the world is reflected all the time in the Congress. Is that the kind of discussions that happen off the floor, you know, between between congressmen?
Well, Peter Domenici is a conservative, but he's very thoughtful, and he's very sincere. I mean, you do have your, as I said in the book, your Darth Vaders and your Dr. Strangeloves, who are basically sort of knee-jerk anti-communists. I mean, you have that anywhere. You have your, in essence, on the other side, your sort of knee-jerk pro-unilateral disarmament type. So you have that. That is the spectrum. But a lot of the members of Congress, I think, reflect their constituents. And if the constituency is pro more defense spending, that's what they'll get. Congress is a remarkable mirror, and which is one of its failings, because it tends to be a mirror more often than it tends to be see itself in a kind of leadership capacity, which is why, by default, you end up with a presidential system in this country.
Let me reintroduce you and invite our listeners to call with any questions or comments. Speaking with Senator Paul Tsongas, Democrat from Massachusetts, we're talking about what has been called the new liberalism, what he has called compassionate realism. He's written a new book that's a reappraisal of liberalism. It's called The Road From Here, Liberalism and Realities in the 1980s. If you have any questions or comments that you'd like to address to him, you can call us at 923-2774. Our area code is 215. The number again is 923-2774, and our phone lines are now open. James Fallows was recently on this program talking about his approach to defense spending, and he's a strong advocate of the draft because he thinks that we need a cross-section of people in the Army and that you can't expect the poorest population of the country to be very committed to preserving the country. What's the country done for them? And that you really have to rely on brain power as much as machines if there is ever a threat to the United States. Do you think that there should be a draft?
Well, that's an interesting question because as we drove in from the airport today, I had an argument with my staff on that issue because I think Fallows' points are well taken. I happen to be opposed to the draft, but I must say that that is a very compelling argument, and one that I'm going to spend some time contemplating, because in fact, if you do not have a society where the average person feels that their kid might be involved in the mistakes of our foreign policy, you have a detachment, which I think is very unhealthy. So Fallows is not, his position is not without argument.
There has been from my understanding, just monitoring different reports, a lot of strong-arming going on in the Congress now. I guess that's typical and not at all unusual.
Yeah.
But it seems that President Reagan really has a talent for convincing people to vote his way. What kinds of talks have there been with you?
With me?
Yeah. I don't know if he'd approach you or not.
Well, I'm not the kind of person that they would approach. One, that I've already voted in the committee against the AWACS deal. And secondly, as I found out when I was in the Lowell City Council, that you're a lot better off being perceived as someone who's rather strong in their views as opposed to someone who's a fence-sitter. Because once you're the perceived fence-sitter, everybody focuses in on you. And what they're basically going after now are those they feel they can turn around. And any president uses the technique. I would, if I were in his shoes, he does it very well. He feels strongly about the issue, and he has a lot to deal with.
What's his technique, from what you know?
One, you say to someone, you know that project in your community you were concerned about or the judge you want us to appoint, you talk about a primary that the person might have next year and the fact that you would not support their opponent. If you want to play hardball when you're in the White House, you have a lot of opportunities. And if I were the president, I'd do exactly the same thing.
Do you think that's a shortcoming of the system? Because, with something like arms sales or nuclear weapons, there are such incredibly crucial decisions that affect ultimately the life of everybody on the planet. And to have votes one way or another because of people's commitment to local projects that don't nearly have that kind of global importance seems practical for the people who are getting the projects, but otherwise kind of illogical.
It's called democracy.
Okay. So you think that way of getting people to vote with you is perfectly acceptable?
If I were president of the United States and I wanted to get the SALT II treaty passed, I would use everything that I could to do it. That would be the use of power in a, quote, progressive, unquote, fashion. I guess I would rather have the power available for use and abuse than not have it at all, in essence, have a kind of drift. It's a double-edged sword.
Okay, well, let's take some phone calls. My guest is Senator Paul Tsongas. If you'd like to get through, our number is 923-2774. We're at area code 215. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yeah, my question would be, wasn't Jimmy Carter a compassionate realist, and what separates compassionate realism from Carterism? And didn't Democrats take this middle-of-the-road line all through the Carter years?
Well, I don't think anybody would argue that President Carter presented, if you will, a philosophy. Let me give you a for instance. If you look at African policy, which is somewhat off the track, you had a very realistic approach in Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, where he, in essence, stood with the negotiations, and you ended up with Robert Mugabe in a very, I think, subtle situation there. That was very pragmatic, very realistic. On the same hand, you had non-recognition of Angola. And even though the Angolans want to get away from the Cuban presence, need to have relations with the United States, have very good relations with American business there, the president was unwilling to recognize Angola. So what you, in essence, send out were very different signals. And that sense of there is not a particular direction over time, I think, eats away at your support. So what you had, in essence, what Ronald Reagan gave the country was a sense of direction, whether you agree or disagree. And President Carter was not perceived that way. He was perceived as having no, if you will, underlying philosophy that governed everything which he did. What I try to argue in the book is how we would approach each issue so that people, as a new issue comes along, would have a sense of how we would do it, and you'd have some expectancy, some predictability as to what your policies are going to be.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay, well, thanks for calling then. Okay, bye-bye. If you'd like to get through, our number is 923-2774. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi. I have a comment on the approach that the senator has outlined in terms of domestic policies, and having grown up in the 50s and 60s, it seems that a lot of what I hear is the Me Too-ism that the Republican moderates were accused of by the conservative Republicans in the 50s and 60s. And the question that I have is that if people are given a choice between a Democrat who is advocating what sounds like conservative policies, and a Republican advocating the same thing, why should someone vote for the Democrat? The second part to that is, the little that I've read about the turnout in the last election, it seemed like the people who are really being affected by the cutbacks in domestic and social programs are those who stayed home, who didn't see, I'm assuming that they didn't see too much of a choice. Your low-income, lower-middle-class people who are being hurt by the cutbacks in the student loan programs and other kinds of things. You know, why should they vote for a Democrat who is essentially saying we can do what the Republicans are doing, but with a little bit more compassion and with better administration?
You want to take that?
Well, I think the point is well taken, that in essence, if we are engaged in nothing but me-tooism, then there's no reason for anybody to vote for us. I guess the question is whether there is a distinction. One, on the so-called social agenda, abortion, capital punishment, that kind of thing. I'm a traditional liberal, and that does not change. So to say that one is not me-too on an issue like abortion, it's not the kind of thing that one, in essence, changes one's mind on because it represents a philosophical base. The issues discussed in the book are the so-called hardware issues, the economy, defense, energy, that kind of thing. So you cannot me too on the social agenda, that nothing of what I say would be attractive to a Jerry Falwell, for example. In terms of the me too-ism on defense, they would give you an arms race, I would give you a rough equivalent. In terms of energy policy, they would bail out Three Mile Island, I would put money into photovoltaics. So there are major differences along the way. Third world policy, they give you the east-west view of the world, I give you a third world view of the world. So there really is a great distinction. On the second point, the turnout was low. In fact, many of the beneficiaries of the programs that we have supported all these years don't bother to vote. I noticed a billboard in town here when I was driving through today that said something to the effect, if you don't vote, don't gripe. The fact is that most of the people, no, I take that back, many of the people who were, in essence, the recipients of the values and the programs that we instituted as Democrats don't bother to vote. And if you don't turn that around, then one is hardly in a position to complain about what's taking place. And the fact is that the right are very active, they're very committed. The moral majority and people like that believe very strongly in what they're doing and willing to go out and fight for it. If we, on the other hand, are not willing to do that, we will be defeated. In fact, that's what happened in 1980.
I think our listener was suggesting, though, that a lot of people stayed home because they felt that they had no choice to make, that there was nothing they could really put their vote behind.
You can say that forever. You know, just think of all the people in the world who would give their life and have given their life for a choice, however pallid that choice may be. That intellectual out is always there. They said the same thing, by the way, in things like the, I remember people saying that during the Kennedy-Nixon years. I remember people saying that during the Nixon-Humphrey. This fellow grew up in the 50s and 60s as I did. I remember very distinctly the McCarthy-Kennedy people being turned off and saying, Humphrey-Nixon, what's the difference? Well, we certainly found out, didn't we?
Okay, thank you for your call.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Our number is 923-2774. I'm speaking with Senator Paul Tsongas. And before we take the next phone call, I'd like you to elaborate on a distinction that you just made when talking with our caller. You said that you don't see things in terms of the east-west split, but rather you have a third world point of view. Can you explain that?
Well, John Foster Dulles once said that neutrality was immoral. And so you'd look at a country and say, are you pro-communist or anti-communist? Are you pro-Castro or anti-Castro? Well, that was obviously after Dulles. That view was pretty much dissipated during Vietnam, where a government that was, quote, anti-communist turned out to be a dog, and we lost a lot of our people and lost of our money in that quagmire. We're now returned to that. So in El Salvador, the question is, are you pro or anti-Castro? Human rights, a non-issue today. That somehow we're proud of the fact that we've turned our back on human rights. That's not going to work. Forget whether you think it's moral or immoral. The fact is that a non-human rights policy, the imposition of an east-west view, simply doesn't work. And we're going to find that out in South Africa, in Namibia, and we're going to find that out in Latin America, to our, I am afraid, great dismay.
How should the United States then be developing policy towards third world countries?
The reality out there is nationalism. The reality in South Africa is there shall be majority rule in South Africa eventually, and you have to be in front of that. The question should be in El Salvador, you straighten out your right-wing military. You embrace human rights, and we have no trouble supporting you. But if you end up not doing that, then you simply are stand for things different than what we stand for, and therefore we will not support you. We'll not overthrow you, but don't expect our support.
Okay. Let's take the next phone call. My guest is Senator Paul Tsongas. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, Senator.
Yes.
I'd like to know whether or not, and I have a couple of questions. The first, maybe a little less argumentative than the second. The first question is, could somebody consider you today's Vito Marcantonio?
I would give you a good answer if I could figure out the question.
Well, you remember who Vito Marcantonio was, don't you?
Well, would it embarrass you if I say I don't?
Oh, okay. He was the representative from the Bronx who was in New York City, who was an avowed communist, or at least who appeared to be.
Well, I was accused, or that earlier listener suggested that I was a Republican. Now I'm accused of being on the other side. You can't both be right.
Well, then you've got to come out.
What's your second question?
You've got to come out a winner, right, Senator?
What's your second question, sir?
Well, the senator didn't respond to the first question.
Well, I think if you read the book, that the last thing you'd accuse me of being a communist, because
okay,
I say
okay,
in the book
fine.
That the Russians are
no,
expansionist
that's fine,
and
that's
are a threat.
Fine. Now, the second question has to do with Zimbabwe and Premier Mugabe,
mm-hmm.
who might otherwise be called, if he were in a member of a British Commonwealth, prime minister.
He is a prime minister.
Right.
Sir, get to your point.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
I'm asking you to get to your point. We have many callers on the line.
Yes, ma'am. Do you think that Mugabe, when he says he wants a one-party state, do you think he really will tolerate an opposition? And do you think that any of those folks tolerate or understand what is meant by a loyal opposition?
You mean the way a Marcos
yeah,
will
yeah.
in the Philippines or a way a Trujillo would or a De Bautista?
Oh, no. Come on, don't throw that at me.
Well,
in the British sense, in the American sense, a loyal opposition.
No, obviously.
Does Mugabe understand a loyal opposition in that sense?
Let's let him answer the question. Thank you for calling.
People come out of different traditions. You have in Africa a tradition of authoritarian rule in tribes. We come from a very different tradition, but Mugabe has moved a great deal in the direction of Western tradition, and I think is doing rather well.
Okay, let's take another phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, I'd like to ask the senator about how he would handle the problem of the Middle East, particularly Israel, or really the whole problem. It's a really complicated question for anyone with presidential aspirations or even, you know, with foreign policy in the Senate or whatever. On the one hand, you've got an ally who is a close ally of the United States, but who is nevertheless intransigent in certain ways and doesn't seem to be tending toward any kind of resolution. It's a very difficult area. I don't know. I just wondered how, if he would recognize the PLO or exactly what he would bring to the problem.
Well, you basically have two issues in the Middle East. One is the Palestinian question, which you alluded to, and the second is the right of Israel to survive. If you don't deal with those two, then the whole armaments issue becomes irrelevant. You simply make all the more volatile the situation. My own view is that the United States should be committed to the right of Israel to survive, and I would draw a distinction, by the way, between Israel and Menachem Begin. I think Menachem Begin, post-Camp David, has really hurt Israel, that he's not a prime minister of the Ben-Gurion, Golda Meir stripe, who basically built up credibility for Israel over time. I think Menachem Begin's really done Israel a lot of damage in the last couple of months, or the last year or so, made perhaps explicit in terms of the bombing of Beirut, which was a strategically indefensible decision and played into Gaddafi's hands. One, you guarantee Israel's right of survival. And secondly, you finally go ahead and resolve the issue of the Palestinians, not a Palestinian state, but certainly to address the issue. And the United States should be in a position to say to Menachem Begin, the settlements policy is unacceptable. And you have to move towards the, in essence, taking away the festering sore of the Palestinian question. Absent resolution on those two, you have nothing but conflict in the future in the Middle East.
Thank you for your call.
All right, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. We're not going to have time to take any more phone calls, so my apologies to those of you who are left on hold. It seems to me that one of the issues that you discuss in your new book that probably has or will bring you a lot of criticism is your stand on nuclear power. You're very, very pro-ecological issues, and a lot of people would see your stand for nuclear power as being a contradiction of your ecology-mindedness.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you support nuclear power?
It's not so much that I support it as that I accept its inevitability for this short midterm. I happen to think that the long-term environmental impact of coal burning, massive coal burning, is disastrous, and that if I were to choose between the known effects of coal burning and taking the risk of nuclear, I'll take the nuclear risk, which is not to like it, but my argument is maximize conservation, maximize renewables, then you go down a very unhappy list. I happen to put coal at the bottom. Other people put nuclear at the bottom. That debate will rage on.
What are your reasons for putting coal at the bottom?
One is the acid rain problem, but I think by far the most important is the so-called greenhouse effect. And indeed, there was an article in the paper about 1 million square miles of Antarctica ice sheet melting in the last 10 years. The long-term impact, especially in this area, of an increase in sea level would be very, very serious. You have strip mining, what that does to agricultural land, miners' deaths, black lung disease, that kind of thing. It's not as exciting as a Three Mile Island, for example, but it's insidious, it's there, people die every year, and one that I think will get more attention as time goes on.
I think nuclear power is pretty unpopular in your area, the area that you're from.
Yes.
Has that lost you a lot of votes?
Well, I think when people... I do a lot of work on environmental issues, as you know, so it is hard for people to sort of put them both together. And since I'm the author of the Conservation Bank and the Solar Bank, that kind of thing, you know, my commitment to renewables is very strong. The question is, if you plug out, in essence, the nuclear option, what are you plugging in? And what I'm saying is, if you then plug in coal, you lose me. And so, and this administration, by the way, is going the opposite direction. They are subsidizing nuclear through Three Mile Island and the Department of Energy, and that's exact opposite of what every major study has called for in terms of energy policy.
Your approach you describe as a way to try to be realistic, to look at problems and find fresh ways of addressing them. What kind of alliances do you expect that you will be able to forge with this point of view? Because you're incorporating different points of view within your point of view.
You can't put together the old coalition. The old FDR coalition, she is gone. And you have to recognize that. And you put together the same coalition I do back home. In other words, people say, well, I disagree with him on gay rights, for example. I happen to be supportive. But a person can say, I disagree with that, but he makes sense. He's done a lot of economic development work, and I can live with that. So in essence, you put together a coalition that will live with your social agenda liberalism, but still recognize that you won't botch up the country. And I think there is a constituency out there. That's what I put together in Massachusetts, and I've never been defeated despite seeming off the wall on a number of particular points.
One of our listeners alluded to your presidential aspirations. Do you have them?
No. That book will not be taken seriously if I'm a candidate in 84, and I'm not a candidate.
Okay. Thanks very much for talking with us. I've really found it very informative. I thank you for being with us. I've been speaking with Senator Paul Tsongas of Massachusetts, and he has tried to reassess liberalism and come up with what he considers to be a fresh way of addressing problems, old problems and new problems. His new book is called The Road From Here, Liberalism and Realities in the 1980s. It's just been published by Knopf. I'd like to thank again our listeners who called, and my regrets to those who didn't get a chance to speak on the air. It's 4 minutes to 3 o'clock. This is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Just about 5 minutes, my guest will be Andrea Lee. At the age of 25, she spent a year in the Soviet Union living on a college campus. So we'll be talking about life on that campus in just a few minutes on Fresh Air.
Thank you.